The gospel reading this morning comes from the gospel according to Matthew, the 17th chapter, verses 1 through 9. This is the text we get every year just before we begin the journey to the cross. So listen now for a word from God to the church this day. 6 days later, Jesus took with him Peter and James and his brother John and led them up a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them, and his face shone like the sun, and his clothes became dazzling white. Suddenly there appeared to them Moses and Elijah talking with him. Then Peter said to Jesus, "Lord, it is good for us to be here. If you wish, I will make three dwellings here, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." While he was still speaking, suddenly a bright cloud overshadowed them, and from the cloud a voice said, "This is my Son, the Beloved. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him." When the disciples heard this, they fell to the ground and were overcome with fear. But Jesus came and touched them, saying, "Get up and do not be afraid." And when they looked up, they saw no one except Jesus himself alone. As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus ordered them, "Tell no one about the vision until after the Son of Man has been raised from the dead." Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. Please pray with me. O God, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all our hearts be acceptable to you. O God, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. Preaching and teaching have been a lot easier in 2017 than in any year I can remember. Most years when I teach adults about Calvin's doctrine of total depravity, that sin is so deep that humans can't seem to escape it, I get a lot of pushback. This year, the adult confirmation class was like, clearly. Most years, I have trouble explaining why Jesus is so strong with his disciples about letting their light shine, or why the Beatitudes necessarily mean that Christians will be in conflict in the world. This year, there seems to be no assumption otherwise. And most year, when I read the Transfiguration story, my first impulse is to wonder, how am I going to convince a bunch of thinking people that you really should stay open to supernatural visions of Jesus transfiguring before several disciples, showing up with dead prophets, that you shouldn't just dismiss it as pre-modern falsities? But this year, my first impulse is less of a thought and more of a yearning for the same assurance that those disciples get, that the way of Jesus is not folly, that it doesn't just end in death, that the way of Jesus has deep roots in the liberation led by Moses and the prophetic power of Elijah. That even when the road ahead looks like a dead end, God's justice is absolutely assured. The neighborhood God promises is absolutely assured. The peace that Jesus promises is absolutely assured. I yearned for that assurance this week when a colleague told me about the immigrants she knows who have their suitcases packed and sitting by the front door ready to flee, not the violence or hunger in their own countries of origin, but fear that they now know in ours. I wanted that assurance when I learned that some parents of children in city schools have been asked to rank whether they'd rather have 40 kids per teacher in a classroom or no arts classes or no professional development training for any of their teachers. And I wanted that assurance when one of our leaders asked if an immigrant teenager who escaped the gangs of Central America to make it to our community, who worked as a janitor every night after school until 11 o'clock at night, if he could come here if and when the ICE raids start. Because for him, this church might be the only chance he has for not being afraid. Frankly, I do not care whether anything supernatural happened on that mountain with Jesus and Moses and Elijah. Apologizing for faith or defending it as if we need the acceptance of others for it to be true is less and less interesting for me. I want the assurance that the disciples got that day, that God is present and active on the road to the cross, that Jesus' way of living is our best hope, that the crosses that nations erect to crucify those most vulnerable among us are the very places where God shows up. I want that kind of assurance. Because we are going to need that kind of assurance heading toward the cross this year. Let's be honest, most years in Lent, we just pretend that we are headed toward the cross. We give up chocolate for 40 days, or we try to be more intentional about praying, or we try to curse less or exercise more. We engage Lent like some universal weight loss program, trim ourselves up a little bit, take better care of ourselves. But who among us actually engages Lent as though we are being prepared for suffering, as though we are being prepared for loss, as though we are being prepared to be tested to see whether we run from the people our government hangs on crosses, or whether we stay there at risk to ourselves? Who among us engages Lent as though we might be called to face some crosses that we might not have the power to stop? Who among us engages Lent as though our walk with Jesus might require us to give up something we cling to much more than chocolate? Something at the center of our lives. It is encouraging to see that the suffering that God is preparing us for isn't something that God sends on us, despite some very popular theology to the contrary. It is not God who gives us suffering that we should be able to handle. It is an empire that traffics in crosses, that hangs people there, and Black History Month ought to remind us of that. Fear is the main tool of empire. Fear leads to othering. Othering leads to scapegoating. Scapegoating leads to violence. God does not send that sort of suffering on people. That is the devil's business. We do not do Lent because God is some kind of sadist who enjoys watching people suffer. That clarification is important because it means that Lent does not have to be the downer that we expect it to be. The downer, I have to say, that we in the church sometimes make it out to be. The point of Lent is not to glorify suffering. It is to strengthen our capacity for enduring it. We do Lent because we need the discipline of soldiers who deprive themselves in training so they are ready for the real thing. We need the discipline of teachers in training who are rigorously evaluated all along the way so that then when they are released into the classroom, they are ready for the challenge. We need the skill of the phlebotomist that I go to at Johns Hopkins. You know, I asked the phlebotomist one time to explain to me how it is that she can get my blood with almost no pain. And she told me there are two things you need to know, honey. The first thing is never let a doctor draw your blood. Nothing against doctors, she said, but they probably do 10 sticks before they let them loose on the patients. They make us do 300 supervised sticks before they let us go. Well, what's the second thing I need to know? Knowledge is no substitute for practice. We do Lent not because God wants us to suffer, but because we need the practice. We need the practice not to flee the crosses that are rising up on our horizon. We need the practice not to flee the children of this city who need the adults to do right by them. We need the practice not to flee the families of new immigrants who are the latest victims of human sin. We need the practice not to flee Muslims in our community who are the latest scapegoats among us. We need the practice to walk to the cross. And you cannot make that walk without other worldly power to strengthen us before we get there. You cannot make that walk without the solid conviction that an ethic of self-preservation rarely leads to the freedom that God promises. You cannot make that walk without the assurance that there is a God who shows up in liberators, in prophets, and in the most ordinary of human beings who is also God. Jesus takes up the mountain a few disciples to catch a glimpse of his power. He allows them to see that there is more to him than most other people will see. A vision they can hold on to when all the world sees is another brown-skinned Jew, another poor man, another human being discarded by empire. A vision of God's power to steady them when the road less traveled is the one that leads them to more danger, to more suffering, toward the cross. Now Peter, he wants to stay there. Stay up on the mountain, far from the crosses we find down in civilization, high up away from the dangers, toils, and snares that human beings create. I know that temptation, up where the air is cool, up where the morning mist cleanses everything, up where the river streams call you to lie down and stay a while. Like Peter, we sometimes need a reminder that the whole point of mystical experiences, of seeing the glory of God, of cathartic worship, is to be sent back out. It is what equips us to face the world. Worship of God isn't complete until we get out there and start practicing our assignments. Maybe some years we need a reminder that transcendent experiences are supposed to send us into the world and not keep us out of it. To fill us up on the mountain so we can come back down for another round. The whole point of the church isn't to fill people with heavenly vision so we can disengage from the world that we are living in. But I don't think we need that reminder this year. I think we all know we can't stay up on the mountain. We don't get to stay there, which is exactly why we need to get up there for a little while with Peter and James and John. Get up there and share the vision. Get up there and glimpse God's power and file it away deep in our hearts. Get up there and believe so that when we come down the mountain into all the muck and the danger and the fear that is before us, we won't lose hope. That's why you go up the mountain. So you come back down filled with hope. We won't lose hope of a beloved community where violence is put down, where opportunity is lifted up and the legacy of slavery is overcome in our city and around the world. We won't lose hope of a world that welcomes war refugees instead of fearing them. We won't lose hope of a city that has the resources it needs to turn around the schools once and for all and do right by children. We won't lose hope of building a world where immigrants don't have to cross borders to feed their families or escape violence. And we won't lose hope because we will have seen a vision of a crucified God, one who doesn't shrink from suffering but loves us and our world that deeply, enough to suffer with us for our sake. We won't lose hope because we will have seen a deeper truth of God's power flowing like that cool stream through the mountains of human history, cleansing every doubt, giving us the assurance that we need that Emmanuel is here. God is with us come what may. God is with us regardless of the crosses that are erected in our land. God is with us regardless of the suffering that we have to endure. God is with us.